protagonists in stories that we're usually not protagonists in. I'm also very interested in aestheticizing abolition. White supremacy and patriarchy has aestheticized itself. It's become a cultural project, not just a political project. So I want to do the same with abolition. I want to show people that abolition is not just a theory inside a book, but it's something that we can practice, and it's something that is culturally relevant for this time.
Well, I want to thank you so much, Patrice Cullors, on being with us and your new book, An Abolitionist Handbook, 12 Steps to Changing Yourself and the World. Patrice Cullors is the New York Times bestselling author of When They Call You a Terrorist. She's an author, educator, artist, and abolitionist, co-founder of Black Lives Matter, and a founder of Reform LA Jails, last year stepping away from her role as executive director of the Black Lives Matter Global Network Foundation. And we will link to your writings and others as you move on. That does it for our show. We have a job opening, human resources manager. Learn more and apply at democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Produced with Renee Feltz, Mike Burke, and so many more. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us. Remember, wearing a mask is an act of love.
Portland.
KABU is proud to co-sponsor the return of Portland Folk Music Society concerts with artists who tour nationally. The five-concert series starts this month, Saturday, February 19th, with Robin and Linda Williams.
Gonna drink sweet honey whiskey.
Give me a good heavy load and a clear stretch of road, and I'll let that old bulldog run.
The Portland Folk Music Series has one show every month through June. The concerts will be at the Reedwood Friends Church on Southeast Steele Street in Portland. For information, go to kboo.fm and click on Community Events.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KABU Evening News.
Coming up on the KABU Evening News. Portland recorded 7 shootings within just 24 hours over the weekend. COVID-19 hospitalizations peak in Oregon, while Moderna's vaccine is granted full FDA approval. And a plea deal for the 2 men convicted of murdering Ahmaud Arbery is rejected. Good evening. This is the KABU Evening News for Monday, January 31st, 2022. I'm Yasmin Kobanoglu. Oregon reported far fewer coronavirus cases in the week ending Sunday, adding 49,760 new cases. That's down 13.5% from the previous week's total. Across Oregon, cases fell in 23 counties, with the best declines in Clackamas, Multnomah, and Washington counties. More than 620,000 people in the state have tested positive for the coronavirus since the pandemic began, and more than 6,000 Oregonians have died. Some Oregon counties have begun reporting backlogged death records, skewing daily death counts. In the week ending Sunday, 150 people were reported dead due to COVID-19. In the week before that, 53 people were reported dead. According to forecasts from the Oregon Health and Science University, hospitalizations are expected to be at their highest right now and for the next couple of days. Health officials say by this time next week, we could start to see a decline in hospitalizations. Healthcare professionals urge people to continue taking safety precautions, especially getting the vaccine and your booster, even if you've had COVID-19 in the past. a Clark County Sheriff's deputy in Washington State, unintentionally shot and killed an off-duty Vancouver police officer on Saturday night. The fatal shooting occurred after the off-duty officer scuffled with an armed robbery suspect at his home. The Vancouver Police Department identified the officer who was killed as 52-year-old Donald Sahota. The Clark County Sheriff's Office had responded to an armed robbery at a Chevron convenience store on Northeast 117th Avenue in Vancouver earlier that night. A man had reportedly pointed a handgun at the clerk and demanded money. Police said the suspect drove away in a stolen vehicle and deputies pursued him. After police used spike strips to stop the car in the battleground area, the suspect ditched the vehicle and ran away. Soon after, a woman called 911 to report that a man who matched the description of the robbery suspect had pounded on her front door and said he had just been involved in a crash. She told dispatch that her husband, Donald Sahota, was an armed, off-duty Vancouver police officer, and he had gone out to the driveway to try and detain the suspect. Police said during a fight with the suspect, Sahota, quote, lost control of his firearm and suffered several stab wounds during the struggle, end quote. The suspect broke free and ran toward Sahota's house, where Sahota's wife was still on the phone with emergency dispatch. Investigators say Sahota was able to recover his gun, then ran after the suspect who was trying to enter the home. Seconds after additional officers arrived on the scene, one Clark County deputy sheriff fired several rounds from a rifle and hit Sahota. The crimes team said Sahota collapsed on his front porch before the responding officers were able to determine that he was the homeowner and not the robbery suspect. Sahota died at the scene, the suspect surrendered and was taken into custody. The Lower Columbia Major Crimes Team is investigating the shooting. Portland police responded to 7 shootings in just 24 hours over the weekend. According to law enforcement data, there have been 89 shootings so far in 2022. KBOO's Josh Salem has more on the story.
Portland recorded a record 7 shootings within a 15-hour period over the weekend. These 7 shootings took place between 2 a.m. and 7 p.m. on January 21st. At least one person died and several others were injured. Last year, the city saw a record number of homicides. 90 murders took place in 2021, breaking the 30-year-old record of 66. The number of homicides rose 83% between 2019 and 2020, a much greater increase than the national figure of 30%. The Portland increase disproportionately affected the Black community. Some homicides were related to gang violence and drug dealing, but the city also saw disputes among the houseless. And there is no doubt the pandemic, financial troubles, and mental health crises exacerbated the problem. Portland police labeled the surge in the number of shootings as concerning. Dealing with them required significant numbers of officers and took resources away from duties like routine patrolling. Investigations of all these shootings remain ongoing. For KBOO News, I'm Josh Salem.
A bill in Oregon's upcoming legislative session aims to reform the criminal justice system to reduce interactions with law enforcement and make changes to the state's parole system. Eric Tegedoff has more on the story.
Advocates for criminal justice reform are continuing their effort to change the system during Oregon's upcoming legislative session. Senate Bill 1510 aims to reduce interactions with law enforcement, a move that proponents see as vital for the safety of people of color. Babak Zulfagari Azar is a member of the Transforming Justice Coalition. He says the bill is part of their work to change the criminal justice system in the wake of George Floyd's murder by Minneapolis police. Zulfagari Azar recalls his own experiences with police.
If the policies that are included in this bill had been in place, then I likely wouldn't be living with those experiences. So it's really a matter of imagining how many fewer people would have those concerns or have those unnecessary criminal records.
The bill would make stops for offenses such as a broken taillight or brake light a secondary offense, meaning it can't be the only reason for pulling someone over. It also requires law enforcement notify people of their right to consent to a search during a stop. The legislation also includes changes for people on parole, preventing some workplace visits by probation officers and enabling some people to report remotely for parole or probation. Zulfagari Azar says this would eliminate some of the obstacles to jobs and housing people face after leaving incarceration.
They're trying to heal. They've been accountable to what happened, to the harm they caused. Let's give them an opportunity to be a contributing member to society, because that's exactly what's going to help public safety.
The bill would create and fund the Justice Reinvestment Equity Program as well. A broad coalition is supporting the effort, including Oregon Food Bank. Matt Newell Chang with the organization says people of color are more likely to be sent to prison than white people for committing the same offenses. He also notes that 90% of people returning from incarceration report struggling to afford food.
So when we have such disparate treatment of our community members, disproportionately sending Black and brown community members to prison, it's no wonder why a higher percentage of Black and brown Oregonians experience food insecurity. It's wrong, and we think it's time to do something about that.
The legislative session starts on Tuesday and is scheduled to adjourn on March 7th. I'm Eric Tegedoff reporting.
A federal judge has rejected a plea deal that would have dropped hate crime charges against two of the men convicted of murdering Ahmaud Arbery. Arbery, then 25 years old, was running through Brunswick, Georgia on February 23, 2020, when three men chased him down in a pickup truck and fatally shot him. According to court documents filed late Sunday, prosecutors submitted a notice of two plea agreements for Gregory McMichael and his son, Travis McMichael, to the U.S. District Court for the Southern District in Georgia. The notices to the court asked that the U.S. Department of Justice dispose of the hate crime charges against the McMichaels. On Monday, Arbery's parents, Wanda Cooper Jones and Marcus Arbery, spoke in court against the plea deal. Cooper Jones said the proposed deal was, quote, disrespectful. The DOJ has charged the three defendants in the hate crimes trial with violating Arbery's rights, attempted kidnapping, and the use of dangerous weapons because of his race. The three men pleaded not guilty to the charges last year. It's unclear whether the third man convicted of murdering Arbery, William Roddy Bryan, has reached an agreement with the DOJ. Jury selection in the trial is scheduled to begin on February 7th. The St. John's Bridge will be closed overnight this week for five nights of maintenance and bridge inspection. The bridge will be closed from 10 p.m. to as long as 5 a.m. the next morning, starting today, Monday, January 31st, through this Friday, February 5th. Pedestrians and bicyclists will still be allowed to use the bridge, with flaggers directing their path. The last two scheduled number 16 TriMet buses of the night at 10:10 p.m. and 10:18 p.m. will also be allowed to cross each night. Emergency vehicles will still be allowed over the bridge during the closure. Nighttime drivers who normally use the bridge will need to make a long detour using North Lombard Street to I-5 to get around the closure. Portland Public Schools announced Friday that Harriet Tubman Middle School students will not be relocated to the Martin Luther King Jr. Elementary School building, as many community members and parents had feared. Harriet Tubman Middle School, which sits next to the I-5 corridor in the Rose Quarter, has long been polluted by the freeway. According to a Portland State University study, the air quality next to the freeway is so dangerous that students should not be allowed to play outside. The Oregon Department of Transportation's plan to widen the I-5 Rose Quarter corridor in an effort to address traffic congestion would move the freeway even closer to the school grounds. Right now, at its closest point, the middle school is about 50 feet away from the freeway. According to early design plans, the freeway project would move the wall separating the freeway from the school less than 25 feet from the building. The PPS board pledged in July of 2021 that if the state moves forward with the freeway project, it will rebuild Harriet Tubman Middle School in a safer and healthier location. However, finding a new location for the school has been a challenge. In an effort to keep the new school locations within the existing boundaries of the Harriet Tubman community, PPS officials proposed relocating the Harriet Tubman student body to the Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Elementary School in the nearby King neighborhood, one of several elementary schools that feed into Harriet Tubman Middle School. Parents and members of the MLK Junior School community immediately rallied against the proposal, citing equality concerns that would come with merging the two majority non-white student populations into a single school or displacing MLK Junior students to other elementary schools. As of 2021, 61% of Harriet Tubman students and 72% of MLK Junior students are people of color. Construction on the Rose Quarter I-5 project is slated to begin in late 2023. According to PPS staff, ODOT's construction directly next to the school can be done during the summers, when school is out of session, until September of 2027, when construction will continue year-round next to the school. That means the middle school must move to a new location by August of 2027 in order to avoid construction-related disruptions. To meet that timeline, the PPS board must decide on a new location for Harriet Tubman Middle School by May of this year. PPS staff estimates that the process of building a new school or upgrading an existing PPS building will take a minimum of 4 years. District staff are expected to provide the PPS board with a list of all the possible future sites on February 1st. The board members will narrow the possibilities down over the next couple months and present PPS staff with 2 possible sites for more in-depth study in mid-April. There will be opportunities for public comment and discussions throughout the board's process. Community members can join the PPS board on February 7th from 5:30 to 7:30 p.m. at the Blanchard Educational Service Center to discuss possible sites for the new Harriet Tubman Middle School. You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for Making Contact, featuring part 2 of a series looking at how COVID-19 has torn through prisons and how organizers are trying to push state and local governments to release inmates in order to contain the spread of the pandemic. Then at 6, it's Labor Radio. And at 6:30, it's Prison Pipeline. Tonight's weather will be rainy with a low of 35 degrees. Tomorrow will again be rainy with a high of 45 degrees. Today in history, in 1950, U.S. President Harry Truman publicly announces his decision to support the development of the hydrogen bomb, a weapon theorized to be hundreds of times more powerful than the atomic bombs dropped on Japan during World War II. The quote of the day is from American educator, author, and advisor to several U.S. presidents, Booker T. Washington, who said, quote, "Success is to be measured not so much by the position that one has reached in life as by the obstacles which he has overcome while trying to succeed." Pharmaceutical company Moderna announced Monday that U.S. health regulators have granted full approval to its COVID-19 vaccine. The shot has already been given to tens of millions of Americans since its emergency use authorization more than a year ago. The move by the U.S. Food and Drug Administration means the agency has completed the same rigorous review of Moderna's shot as dozens of other long-established vaccines. The decision was bolstered by real-world evidence from the more than 200 million doses administered in the U.S. since the FDA cleared the shot in December of 2020. Another pharmaceutical company, Pfizer, was also granted full approval of its COVID vaccine last August. Public health advocates initially hoped the regulatory distinction would boost public confidence in the shots, but there was no discernible bump in vaccinations after the Pfizer approval. More than 211 million Americans, or about 63% of the total population, are fully vaccinated. About 86 million people have gotten a booster dose. Vaccinations peaked last spring at more than 3 million per day, and now average less than 750,000 per day. The pace of vaccinations briefly spiked following news of the Omicron variant in December, but has slowed once again. Arkansas Governor Asa Hutchinson says Trump should not lead again. President Joe Biden highlights infrastructure after the Pittsburgh Bridge collapse, and U.S. Military General Mark Milley urges Russia to stand down as Ukraine tensions continue. With more on the story, it's Nadia Ramlagan with 2022 Talks.
Welcome to 2022 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times. And Joe Biden's weakness and incompetence is creating a very real risk of World War III. Look at what's going on. This would have never happened with us.
At a campaign-style rally in Texas on Saturday, former President Donald Trump bashed President Joe Biden's handling of North Korea and the Afghanistan withdrawal. The former president said he might run again and said if given the chance, he would pardon people charged with criminal offenses after the January 6th Capitol attack. Trump ally South Carolina Republican Senator Lindsey Graham called the pardon proposal inappropriate. Graham told CBS he didn't want to send the signal that it is okay to defile the Capitol. Republican Arkansas Governor Asa Hutchinson, the current National Governors Association chair, said Trump should not lead the party or the country again. After touring the site of a bridge collapse in Pittsburgh over the weekend, President Biden stressed the need for nationwide infrastructure improvements and touted his Build Back Better plan.
Across the country, there are 45,000 bridges in poor condition. It's just simply unacceptable.
In COVID-19 news, cases are declining in many parts of the country. On Sunday, White House top medical advisor Dr. Anthony Fauci said things were, quote, looking good and going in the right direction. Spotify says it will add a content advisory to guard against COVID-19 misinformation. Joe Rogan's podcast there has provoked backlash for false vaccine claims. The United Nations Security Council will press Russia on its threatening Ukraine, according to the U.S. ambassador to the U.N. An Army Joint Chiefs of Staff Chair, General Mark Milley, urged Russia to stand down and choose diplomacy.
Armed force should always be the last resort. Success here is through dialogue.
Ireland has marked 50 years since Bloody Sunday, when British soldiers killed 13 while firing on a crowd of largely Catholic protesters. Thousands marked the anniversary of one of the turning points of the Troubles in Northern Ireland. Just days after the banning of Mouse by a Tennessee school district, two editions of Art Spiegelman's Pulitzer Prize-winning book about the Holocaust have reached the top 20 on Amazon. The McMinn County School Board voted to remove Mouse due to inappropriate language and an illustration of a nude woman, according to minutes from a board meeting. Finally, thousands of customers were without power in Massachusetts after a historic blizzard dumped as much as 2 feet of snow on Saturday. Boston tied its record for the most snow to fall in one day, with the city's sixth largest snowstorm of all time. I'm Nadia Ramlagan for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
The Oneida Nation is the first tribe in Wisconsin to offer sports betting, and Native Americans in the UK are part of the Change the Mascot campaign. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The upcoming Super Bowl is expected to bring one of the year's peak times in sports betting. Increasingly, tribal casinos are hoping customers will make a sports wager there. Chuck Kornbach of station WUWM in Milwaukee reports on a tribe in Wisconsin now offering sports betting.
The Oneida Nation Casino near Green Bay recently added 20 electronic kiosks offering sports betting. The tribe's chief financial officer for gaming, Chad Foos, describes the options on the kiosk touch screen.
On the left-hand side, you have all your major league sports, all your collegiate sports. You can make bets on the day of a game, or you can make bets on which is called a futures pick. So if you want to predict who's going to win the Super Bowl in February, you can make that bet also.
Upstairs in his office, Foos said sports has a big following in Wisconsin.
We wanted to match or blend our sports fanatic with leisure gaming to give our customers and potential customers even a better experience.
Foos says the Oneida Casino offers a safe and closely regulated way to bet on sports. After an agreement last year, the Oneida have the only legalized sports betting venue in Wisconsin, though the St. Croix Chippewa have since reached a similar deal with the state. And the CEO of the Forest County Pottawatomie Hotel and Casino in Milwaukee, Dominic Ortiz, recently told a business group that he's interested in a new agreement.
We'll bring sports betting. We're going to challenge Chicago with the assets and the liveliness of the excitement that we're going to bring to Pottawatomie.
A few other tribal casinos in the U.S. have started offering sports betting since the federal government gave its okay 4 years ago. But some tribes with gaming facilities say they're holding off while they determine if adding sports betting is worth it financially. The Oneida already sense more profits. They're building a 2,000-square-foot sports betting lounge at their main casino and planning to let gamblers place a sports bet while on designated tribal land using an app on their phone. For National Native News, I'm Chuck Quirnbach.
Some Native Americans living in the United Kingdom were instrumental in a campaign to eliminate a Native American-themed mascot and logo used by an English rugby team. 2 years ago, fans of the Exeter Rugby Club began seeking the changes and invited Leandra Neffin, who's Omaha living in England, along with some other Native Americans, to be part of the movement. She says last year, the team ended the use of its mascot.
The Big Chief mascot, which was a kind of a caricature cartoon figure dressed in a war bonnet, doing the tomahawk chop. And the fans would wear war bonnets, these kind of fake, brightly colored feather headdresses, banging a drum, doing the tomahawk chop chant. And so it's all very stereotypical type imagery.
Last week, Exeter team officials announced the end of its Native American themed logo. A new brand launching this summer draws from Celtic culture.
They had actually this rich history of Celtic chiefs who were a part of their ancestry, their genetic makeup, that they could actually be celebrating and using as an opportunity to highlight in schools, to educate the people of Devon and Exeter around their own ancestry without having to co-opt a tribe or a people who had no connection to Exeter Chiefs Rugby Club.
The logo will change from a Native American with a headdress to a Celtic helmet known to be worn in and around 300 BC. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Portland's annual Cascade Festival of African Films returns this February. In-person screenings are back after last year's fully virtual event. With more, here's KBOO's Ethan Sandweiss.
At 32 years, the Cascade Festival of African Films is a Portland institution. A committee of academics and film buffs selects a handful of the year's best films from across the continent and among the diaspora. Festival coordinator Tracy Francis is on her sixth year with the festival, and she's transitioning back to an in-person festival as safely as possible.
Last year was completely virtual, and this year we are easing back into in-person, so we're doing a hybrid festival. So we're going to have four in-person screenings, limited capacity, a lot of safety precautions, and then everything will also be available online to watch.
How did you select the films that you were going to screen in person?
So we have for our in-person screenings, they're kind of our special events. So we have our opening night film, which this year we're doing something a little different. We selected actually a documentary and a short film that actually features some Portland artists in them, and they're kind of celebrating community and the diaspora connections between folks in the U.S. and folks in Africa. So we thought that was a nice way to kind of have that community celebration and come back together, you know, both in person and virtually. And then our centerpiece weekend, it's another kind of big event we usually have. And so I usually select kind of the big cinematic films that we really want to see on the big screen for those. And then one of them was only available to show in person, so that was an easy decision to make for that. And then our other in-person event will be our closing night celebration. So we have a wonderful Ethiopian film for that, and that's part of our Women Filmmakers Week. So that's kind of how we just did our big events as our in-person ones for this year.
This year's Cascade Festival of African Films will take place between February 4th and March 5th. Screenings online and in person are free. For more information, visit africanfilmfestival.org. With KBOO News, I'm Ethan Sandweiss.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Monday, January 31st, 2022. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Josh Salem and Ethan Sandweiss. The producer is Yasmin Kobanoglu, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Nadia Romlagon, Mark Richardson, Eric Tegedoff, and Dr. Anthony Lizowitz. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kbu.fm/eveningnews. You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Yasmin Kobanoglu, coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO. At 8, it's Too Much Information with Abe and Tracy, covering politics and current events while taking listener calls. At 9, it's Alternative Radio, featuring lectures and interviews with progressive thinkers. At 10, it's Tin Can Phone. At 11, it's Times Like Now with host Trevor Collins. Then at 11:30, it's Art Focus. Host Joseph Gallivan interviews visionary painter Noel Taylor about his form of abstract psychedelic art. All of these KBOO programs, including the evening news, are made possible by support from our members. If you'd like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kbu.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for Making Contact.
Making contact.
Making contact.
I'm Salima Hamarani, and on today's Making Contact.
Every decision CDC made during that time to even contain it was all wrong and uncaring.
We're airing part two of our series, The Pandemic Inside, COVID and Prisons. We talk about re-entry and what happens to people released in the middle of a global pandemic.
To finally get out and not know about this pandemic, not know how to protect yourself, and you die right away, you just never had a chance.
And we take a look at pretrial detention in Florida jails.
Most organizers working in this space are advocating for an end to pretrial detention because they understand that money bail is only one part of it.